terror mio stolto, vedi a ceffi di birra in ogni volta. La pila, la colonna, a piede la Madonna mi scrisse mia sorella.
Right, and now to tell us what that was and who that was, we've got the artistic director of Opera Roanoke with us here at WVTF this afternoon, live and in our studio and on our stage. Scott Williamson is here, and he's brought some music with us and a wealth of knowledge that I couldn't even approach to discuss the upcoming exciting season of Puccini classics for Opera Roanoke. Welcome to WVTF Music, Scott.
Thank you, Jeff. Great to be here, and you are too kind. Thanks for letting me share and letting me play in your sandbox this afternoon. We just heard the opening of Tosca, the very dramatic set of three big brass chords, which represent the drama's villain, the Scarpia, who we'll meet a little bit later. The first person that we meet in the opera is an escaped political prisoner. And so we know right off the bat that this is a melodrama. And Puccini was not necessarily the first to do so, but the one with whom we identify this signature opening of dispensing with an overture or a sinfonia, as mm-hmm. was the custom in Italian opera and in much romantic opera, and just getting right into the action. So we really hear that in Tosca, which is one of those operas that is beloved by audiences and musicians alike, because it's so incredibly put together, such thrust and drive, such sweep and passion. It really is one of those quintessential Italian operas.
And yet, when it began, the critics, as is so often the case, critics weren't crazy about it, right? The public liked it.
That's right.
Not
to jump the gun on anything we're going to talk about, but earlier today I was introducing the new Met Live in HD season, which kicked off, which is happening right now, with Bellini's Norma. And I was reminded that the opening of Norma was also somewhat of a fiasco. Hmm. It's something that has plagued a lot of these great masterpiece operas. La Traviata is another famous example. So there always seems to be drama around these dramatic productions.
So fitting.
Exactly. Okay. Backstage drama. It's always been with opera and always will be. It's part of the theater, and part of what makes it so exciting on stage is the personalities that are coming together to put these pieces together. Puccini was a notorious personality, you know, very colorful, flamboyant, temperamental, and a great genius. So mm-hmm. it's exciting to consider that Puccini, though he's a classic and seems so far removed from us, Puccini worked with conductors like Toscanini, who worked with conductors that my colleagues and I have worked with. So we feel, you know, even though I've never, of course, worked with Toscanini, that connection that we have to this tradition, not just Puccini, but classical music, is really rich. I find it very moving.
I read somewhere that Toscanini was indeed supposed to conduct, or Puccini wanted him to conduct the premiere, the debut in 1900, and but because it was
Toscanini ended up conducting the second production when it was mounted again,
but he wanted
and
it
did,
to,
did really well.
But somebody wanted it to debut in France, right? But they moved it.
Debuted in Rome.
Yeah.
So and they imported. There was drama around the fact that Puccini's colleagues, his publishers, imported their set and design from La Scala in Milan, and the Romans didn't take too kindly to that. So thankfully today we get along well with our colleagues, and we share resources pretty well. So I'm grateful for that.
Indeed, you are. You mentioned the Live in HD events, which started, I guess, today.
That's right.
Over at Virginia Western. That's a collaborative effort
it
with
is.
Opera Roanoke.
That's
right.
Virginia Western and Opera Roanoke co-sponsor the Met Live in HD broadcast. This is our seventh season doing it. And I every week that I'm available, I do a live introduction about a half hour before, and had a good, lively session today talking about Bellini, talking about divas and bel canto and Maria Callas, who is also a famous Tosca. So that's a wonderful way to experience the Met without leaving Roanoke. When you're not tuning in on WVTF on the radio, come drop by Virginia Western. We'd love to have you there.
It's everywhere.
It has made opera, you know, perhaps more popular than ever, certainly because of the HD broadcasts and other, you know, the springing up of smaller opera companies, not just here in Virginia, but elsewhere. It's a trend around the country that opera is popular with a younger generation of artists and audiences. So it's exciting. And the service that WVTF Music is offering by doing some introductory sessions, that introductions by my colleague Stephen White, really exciting for us, you know, for our audiences here to have a conductor who's been associated with Opera Roanoke and at the Metropolitan Opera since 2009, doing these brief introductions to each of the radio broadcasts. So
okay.
Lots of great opera.
I don't know if anybody knows about that yet. So
am I revealing a secret?
No, but maybe we ought to explain that this is something brand new for WVTF Music, that this year for our Met broadcasts, on the day before each broadcast at 12:06 following the noon news on A Little Day Music with Kevin Sanders, that White is going to be here to talk about the next day's opera.
Right.
That's going to be, that's just good for everybody.
Yeah.
It's going to tell us a little bit, give us some anticipation of what's coming up the next day, and we'll learn about the opera and hear it from an expert. And it's just a good way to
A great way to spend 15 minutes of your lunch hour on a Friday afternoon before a Saturday matinee broadcast.
That'll be very good.
Yes.
So we hope people, and of course the Met season on the radio starts in December, and we hope you'll be listening for that. I think that starts December 1st is when the Met weekly previews with Stephen White begin here on WVTF. Let's get back to Tosca, which is also, by the way, on the Met season. And on the Live in HD season coming up, it'll be in January. But, and I mentioned to you before we went on the air, I wanted to know a little bit about the planning process. How long ago did somebody say, let's do a Puccini season?
Sure. Sure, that's a great question. I wanted to get in that audiences have a chance to see Tosca here first, because our production opens October 27th and runs the evening of the 27th and the afternoon of the 29th at the Jefferson Center.
Mm-hmm.
And so we began planning this production over a year ago, and first started talking about a Puccini season maybe 2 to 3 years ago. Our planning seasons 2 to 3 years out at a time, and they morph as artists' availability changes and as other variables. There are so many variables in putting together an opera. So we first try to identify, what in our rotation of repertory operas like Puccini, Tosca, Boheme, what is up next in that rotation, because we cycle through these operas in order to keep them a vibrant part of the repertory and have new audiences have a chance to hear Boheme at least, once every 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
But not every other year, because there are so many other things that we want to do. And since we do two productions a year, it's we have to be very careful and consider a lot of different factors. So we began planning this Puccini season more specifically about a year ago, reached out to artists. I heard our Tosca, Emily Johnson, who's making her role debut. She was last in Roanoke singing in Falstaff in 2008 as a mezzo-soprano, and since then she's made a switch to dramatic soprano. I heard her sing not only music from Tosca, but also some Zalame, some Strauss, some really, big, heavy stuff. And she sounds great. And I'm really, excited to have her back and proud of her accomplishment. So we reached out and got these artists. We have a fabulous tenor, Dinyar Vanya, who's been with us several times before. And Dinyar is one of those singers who has a pretty big career. He sings in major houses, and so we're honored that he still makes time in his schedule to come to Roanoke and sing a signature role. And then I'm also really happy to have Thomas Cannon back. Thomas was in my very first production as artistic director, which was Madame Butterfly, where he sang the role of Sharpless. And he just added Scarpia to his list of roles this past summer, so it's practically a brand new role for him. And that brings an excitement. That's one of the wonderful things about doing opera here, is that we are able to work with super talented friends in the business, many of whom are doing their roles for the first time or are doing their roles here because they simply like being part of this opera family. And we have a great time putting them together, despite the tragedy and heaviness that is seen and heard from the stage. There's a lot of fun that happens backstage to make that drama possible.
You mentioned the heavy drama. This is and somewhere along the line I saw something about it being appropriate for the weekend before Halloween. There's murder, there's suicide,
exactly.
there's torture.
There's a high body count in Tosca. It is one of those musical thrillers.
Uh-huh.
And it was at a period where, melodrama, the over-the-top, this kind of grand, late romantic Victorian idea was still in vogue. And so at Tosca, we jump right in with an escaped political prisoner. The next excerpt we will listen to will be the tenor aria. The tenor is an artist. He's a painter. Tosca is an opera about an opera singer.
Mm-hmm.
So that angle has made Tosca a beloved piece of artists, because we identify with these characters, and that there's a lot of drama going on the stage sometimes is a great outlet for an artist who needs that means of expression.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if I said that clearly.
It was clear to me. And you mentioned the next thing we're going to listen to.
Yeah.
Would that fit in here?
Let's listen to Pavarotti, the great Luciano Pavarotti, singing the tenor aria Recondita Armonia, beautiful harmony in which the painter Cavaradossi, as he's working on a canvas of the Maddalena, is comparing his lover Tosca's dark eyes and dark features to the blonde features of the model for his fresco in one of the great Roman cathedrals. And this is Puccini kind of introduced. This is about a minute after the character appears on stage, so no time is wasted in getting right into this lyrical beauty with amazing orchestration. The colors that Puccini uses in his orchestra remind us that he was a contemporary of Debussy, and someone who was a brilliant orchestrator. So, Recondita Armonia.
Eccellenza, va,
fa il tuo piacere,
pieno il paniere, fa penitenza,
fame non ho,
mi rincresce.
Mm-hmm. va di quando esce chiuda,
va.
Ah, that kind of cut off there. and Pavarotti?
Yes.
All right.
Pavarotti singing Cavaradossi's first aria Recondita Armonia from the beginning of Tosca.
Well, Scott Williamson is with us. He's the artistic director with Opera Roanoke, and we're talking about Puccini and Tosca, which is the first production coming up later this month for the new season. And I have so many questions about opera because I know so little about it. Each opera seems to have signature pieces. Call it the hit song from
sure.
the opera, if you will. And is that something... This is one of those operas, as I understand it, where the music and the story are kind of progressive. They go along together.
Right.
And yet there are these show-stopping moments. Is that something when somebody writes an opera that they think about, oh, I've got to put a great song here, or is that just something
Definitely.
That happens?
No, it's a conscious choice. I believe the way a playwright writing a great monologue or okay. writing a great dialogue scene between two main characters, you know, wants to give them really good lines to speak, good words to chew on, you know, perhaps a twist or a turn or a surprise here and there. And so, yes, very much, you know, Verdi, you know, Puccini's great predecessor, would sometimes withhold some of his arias until the last minute because he didn't want the critics to get a hold of them. You know, at a time when opera was popular and the sheet music was printed basically to coincide with the premieres of the operas, he didn't want the sheet music of some of his arias getting out and being sung on the streets while the opera was still being premiered.
Yeah,
so, and with Puccini, what's interesting in that excerpt we just heard, chances are after the high note, as the tenor ends his aria, there's going to be some applause in the audience. And if that were a live recording after Pavarotti singing that aria, there most definitely would be applause. And the conductor, you know, most conductors choose to stop and then just restart. But Puccini is writing his operas in a style that suggests that he does want them to continue, that they are, as you said, a progressive part of this narrative. When we get around to Tosca's signature aria, you know, we'll hear at the end where the applause can go.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And these are also, I guess, what draw the artists, the singers, draws them to a role.
Sure.
Right?
I mean, sure.
If there's a great aria, if there's some kind of very powerful moment, that's something
yeah.
they want to
yeah.
be able to express and be known for
right,
achieving.
Right. It's as if the aria mm-hmm. is kind of the quintessence, you know, the kernel, the seed, the center of this role that, you know, an artist is trying to inhabit and bring to life. An aria is like you said, a signature way of doing that in opera.
And as you hinted before, we're very fortunate. We're not only fortunate here to have Opera Roanoke. I mean, the cultural life of Roanoke for the city and the region of its size is exemplary. And we're very, very fortunate
to
have
keep pinching
so
ourselves.
Much. But also then within that context, these singers that you cast, these people, as you said, that like to cooperate and work with the company here, we're really lucky to get some really star quality people on the stage.
We are. Opera Roanoke has long. I'm very grateful to have inherited a tradition of really top notch casting. You know, Opera Roanoke's casting has been consistently acclaimed. You know, for much of its 40-year history and virtually all of its history as a professional company these last, mm-hmm. you know, 2.5 decades, 25 years or so. And that's a joy. And now we have an additional resource and treasure trove, if you will, of talent in the form of our apprentice program. We have an apprentice mm-hmm. artist program that started in 2011, and it's designed for local artists. So we have Virginia Tech students, and we have recent graduates from colleges across the U.S., young artists who are either from here or relocated here. We have students from many of the region's colleges and universities. We also have students from Radford, from Hollins. We've had graduates from Roanoke College, graduates from Liberty University. So we're really, really happy about this program. Our artists are all local and regional, and they not only participate in our productions, some of them will be essaying supporting roles in Tosca. Others will be in the ensemble, in the chorus. And they also perform special programs around the community for schools, for civic organizations. We just did a season preview of mostly Puccini excerpts that the apprentices performed at Hollins University just a few weeks ago. So mm-hmm. they're very active. We're currently planning behind the scenes our first ever apprentice opera. We have a new piece that's being written for us. So I'll talk more about that next time once we're a little further along. But it's an exciting development for our program. And
well, that's what an enormous opportunity. And again, it's where we're lucky that a student, a college student who is interested in pursuing some kind of a career, I guess, or some kind of advancement of their interests, if nothing else, they don't have to go to L.A. or New York or something. But we've got opportunities that can kind of set them on a path here.
Exactly.
Thanks to having a professional opera company in our region.
Yeah. We do a lot more than the two big productions that are our most, I guess our most public a sign of being an opera company, those two big productions that we do in the fall and the spring. And they are, of course, at the heart of our mission. But we do so much in between those productions and so many things around town that some folks don't know about. And those who do are always eager to learn when the next thing is. So
and that's one of the reasons we're here now.
Hey.
Yeah. Because, again, to emphasize that point, all of a sudden, you see ads in the paper or you see something on TV, you hear about, oh, they're doing an opera. And then months go by before you hear about the next opera and then the next season. But there is a continuum of all kinds of little web reaching out of activity at varying levels that make this a part of the community and a part of the culture of our area, which is just so laudable.
Well, thank you. We're grateful to be here. We're grateful for all the support.
Let me do a couple of things here, and then we'll come back and talk about this long tenor note you were telling me about.
All right.
Scott Williamson from Opera Roanoke, our guest on Weekend Classics from WVTF Music. Opera Roanoke is the topic right now here on Weekend Classics. Scott Williamson is our guest. He's the artistic director. Briefly, before we get to this long note, what does the position of artistic director encompass?
Everything.
Okay.
Everything. All aspects. Because we have a small staff, we do with a staff of two what other opera companies, do with staffs of 20. We adapt ways to make it work. But yes, I'm looking at every single department in the production. I'm looking at all of the things behind the scenes, the fundraising, the marketing. All of those things. So it's quite a task. Being a modern day impresario, and it's a wonderful challenge, and quite an exciting one as well.
Yeah, I would like that rather than being pigeonholed into one little bit of it.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't say control or maybe I should, but you have influence. At least you've kind of got your hand
sure,
in just
it's,
about
it's,
everything
it's,
that's
it's
going
interesting.
On.
The opera impresario, not that he or she was fully formed at the birth of public opera in 17th century Venice, but it is remarkable how similar the roles have been over the centuries and the shifts and cultural changes. We have to be masters of many trades. We have to negotiate deals with agents and deal with artists. I'm happy to be dealing with artists who are my friends, and that makes it easier.
Mm-hmm.
Negotiating with our colleague organizations, working out how we put this behemoth of a production together. We are using a theater and its resources. We're using a full symphony orchestra in the pit. We have a cast of 8 to 10 principal artists every show, and a chorus of another 20 or two dozen. Sometimes, as in Tosca and La Boheme, we also have a children's chorus joining us. So we're really happy to have the Roanoke Valley Children's Chorus for both these productions. But there are so many different parts which make it complicated, which make it expensive, which make it incredibly challenging and also incredibly rewarding.
Right.
When all of those constituent parts come together, when they come together at any given stage. For example, you were asking me earlier about planning the production. We have production meetings via Skype and FaceTime with our production team, months in advance leading up to a production. And then on Wednesday of this next week, the cast will assemble. We'll have our production team in the same room for the first time. And we'll hit the ground running on Wednesday, which will be exciting. And that will be, kind of that first day of rehearsal is a milestone in the process, because everyone involved in the opera spends months preparing. The roles that everyone assumes are major roles. So, it's a great challenge, and production time is my favorite time of a season. So,
good. What is?
Oh,
we're
so
going to hear something.
We're going to hear a little treat. I couldn't imagine being a guest on a show and talking about Tosca without playing at least one live excerpt. And if you're going to play a live Tosca excerpt, then chances are it's going to include Franco Corelli or Maria Callas. And in this case, it's Franco Corelli not interpolating a high note, but holding a high B flat for an incredibly long time in such a way that is obvious. It is a gesture. He is stepping outside what we call the fourth wall and saying, hey, listen to how well I can sing this note. And it happens to be on the word vittoria, victory. And he's basically laughing in the face of his nemesis, whose team has just lost a game, basically. If we use an analogy in the sports season, so it's a way that the tenor is kind of thumbing his nose back at the baritone. And in this performance from 1967 in Parma, the great Italian tenor Franco Corelli singing one of his signature roles, he holds it until they burst into applause and interrupt the scene. You'll hear the applause over top of the orchestra, which is trying to continue playing. So this is one of those classic moments. Comes in Act Two, right in the middle of the action. So...
We'll just continue the laugh. Well, that was quite a note. Now, is that something that a male diva would do? I mean, it sounds hammy to me. Like,
right.
How can he do that? Isn't there a director who says, no, just you can't?
I think they started saying it after Corelli.
Oh, okay.
I think it, as I understand it, it became a tradition with tenors because the tenor in this Puccini opera has a great moment in the first act and a great moment in the third act. But this is his only moment in Act Two. He's not on stage very much because he's off stage being tortured. And Act Two is really this big dramatic cat and mouse game between the other two principals, Tosca and Scarpia. So it became a tradition for tenors to kind of thumb their nose at the establishment, if you will, because that's what Scarpia mm-hmm. represents. And the dramatic moment is just taken out completely out of context and turned into a musical one of musical heroism rather than just political, you know, or, you know, social heroism. Now I expect that not only will we not have a disruption from the audience at the Jefferson Center on October 27th or 29th when Dinyar Fania sings that note, but I do expect that he will make a very memorable moment out of it, and probably not much more because it's now the tenors have reined it in somewhat.
Okay. But see, everyone listening to us now who's in the audience is going to be wondering, you know, is he going to hold that Victoria?
Well, I'll make sure I tell Dinyar about this interview, and he'll probably give me grief for the Corelli comparison, because Corelli is one of those tenors that we singers put up on a pedestal.
Well, that's exactly where I was going next with the Scott Williamson, artistic director, Opera Roanoke, is our guest on Weekend Classics. You are a singer. You said we singers, just
right.
And I wanted to ask you,
sure.
I mean, here you are with your fingers and all these different things going on as artistic director. Do you have a performing background in opera?
I do. Yeah. I studied music. I went to James Madison and studied music there, then went to Westminster Choir College and studied there. And between my master's degree and doctorate, I taught at Washington and Lee University and also at Shepherd University, and began performing with Opera Roanoke and also helping behind the scenes assist the chorus, prepare the chorus, assist Stephen White, who was then music director and artistic director. So I was getting, I guess, on the job training in both regards. I had a freelance career as a singer. I lived in New York for several years and kept coming back to Roanoke, both to sing and to be an assistant conductor and occasionally conduct a show before I got the call to come here in 2010 as artistic director. So it continues to be a challenge to maintain that balance. You know, of course, as a performer, you know, you got to keep your chops up. And thankfully, I stay busy enough and have enough opportunities in the region that, you know, I keep my chops up.
Okay. Well, when you got that opportunity, were there other things you were looking? Did you have a path in your mind, a career path, or did that kind of interrupt it and put something in front of you that said, whoa, I can't pass this up?
Well, that's a good question, and I'm surprised no one's asked me it before. I didn't have a path in that, okay, I want to be an artistic director at a company like Opera Roanoke, then I want to go from there to a bigger company because I eventually want to get to the Met. Or it wasn't a goal-oriented approach. When I, after spending a few years in academia, finishing graduate studies, you know, figuring out which path I wanted to take, I hit upon being a performer, and conducting is also performing. So I knew that I wanted to make music at the highest level, and so when I was while I was still performing in a mostly freelance capacity based out of New York with an agent there, I still accepted conducting engagements and still did some teaching. I've always loved teaching and loved being a part of an academic community, so I'm grateful that we have so many great departments within reach here. So I thought, well, okay, what's next? And then I found myself directing a professional chorus in Norfolk. It was the closest thing to a full-time, non-profit, professional arts administration job I had had at that point. I had done a lot of freelancing and part-time things. And so I was in Norfolk when Roanoke said, hey, how'd you like to come take Stephen White's place? And I was like, well, I can't do that, but I can come be me. So.
All right. Do you have favorite things, roles, things you like to conduct?
My tastes. Oh, thank you. Yeah. Well, Gustav Mahler is one of my favorite composers, and often the one I mentioned first. I find myself listening to symphonic music as much as anything when I'm just listening for my own pleasure and to feed my own soul. If it's not music I'm working on. I do love Puccini. I love modern opera. I love a lot of 20th century music and opera. So my tastes are, perhaps a little bit more eccentric than a lot of my opera colleagues. But I love Benjamin Britten, one of my favorite composers, and I think one of the great composers to set the English language. So I'd love for Opera Roanoke to bring Midsummer Night's Dream, for example, to our audiences, because that's an opera that we could do and would do well, and it's a wonderful, wonderful, charming, beautiful and enchanting piece. Mm-hmm. So those are a couple favorites. I have too many to name.
I won't ask about these meetings of things coming up in the next year or two. Are there some works that sometime in the future you would, besides Midsummer Night's Dream?
Oh, sure.
That are there things that you really are anxious to?
Well, we're excited to have another collaborative opportunity with the Moss Center at Virginia Tech. When the Bernstein Centennial came around, we're now talking about possibly doing a production of Candide. That's still in conversation, so I don't know that I should be saying this here. But since it's a Virginia Tech radio station, we hope that we'll be able to work that out. So that's on the wish list, on the wish list, and returning to the Moss Center is on the list, regardless of whether it's with Candide or something else. We haven't done Don Giovanni in a long time. Mozart, great Mozart drama, and I feel like that's an opera that should be in the rotation because it's such a great one. Mm-hmm. Another thing that's on the radar that we haven't done in quite some time now, which again is one to do, every decade or so to get new audiences in front of it, is Hansel and Gretel. Another great, opera that's not performed as often, but is absolutely gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And of course, it is a family friendly story, so it's a way to introduce, new generations of audiences to the opera. So that's something we want to do as well.
And that makes me want to dig just a little bit further into your distant past and when you first heard opera, when you first heard classical music, when was there awareness?
I was by no means a prodigy. I didn't study music seriously until undergraduate. I had a very good high school choral director and had some good high school choral experience and a few solos. I had enough of a voice to get into the music program at JMU and get a small scholarship there. I actually, at the time of my freshman year, my voice wasn't developed enough, and my scholarship required that I have two ensemble credits. So I didn't get into the more select choir. wasn't good enough at that time, and so they said, well, there's room in the opera ensemble. You could do the opera, and they were doing Merry Widow, an operetta, and I had never heard opera singers up close and personal like that, and one of the tenors who would go on to be would come to be one of my closest friends, John Bellamer, sang a high C, and I'd never heard a, a, a voice make that sound before, and I was just hooked, literally. So, you know, I found myself on days where I didn't have rehearsal or in between rehearsals going to the music library and taking at that time mostly LPs because CDs were pretty brand new. So most of my first opera experiences were with headphones in the JMU music library listening to LPs.
Wow. There's nothing, whether it's a tenor or an instrument or a chorus or what have you, there's nothing like having the music go directly from the source to your ears and your presence.
Yes. Yeah.
And of course, that's the crux of what we have when we have Opera Roanoke presenting Puccini. And I hope people will take advantage of that opportunity.
I hope they will.
I assume tickets are still available.
Oh, of course.
Maybe I shouldn't assume.
No, tickets are still available. And they start at very reasonable rates. Students are free. We have a free student ticket program, so students just need to show their ID at the box office to get a free ticket. We also have been opening up our final dress rehearsal to students and special groups, so anyone who's interested can get in touch with our office, and we can share those details, operaroanoke.org. You know, we've got links to our email there. So, yeah, lots of opportunities to interact. We talked a little bit about our apprentice program. Next Saturday, a week from today, after introducing the next Met Live in HD broadcast of Magic Flute, I'll be taking some of our apprentices to the Taubman Museum for a listening to paintings program, a program that we have been doing now with the Taubman Museum for several years. It was a brainchild of Cindy Peterson and myself, where we pair music and poetry with art that is on exhibition, and we find ways to talk about art and music using some of the same vocabulary, you know, the chromaticism, harmony, color, light, balance, form, all these words that we use in one context can inform the other one. And as you're looking at a painting or walking around a sculpture while listening to an opera singer sing an aria or a song, it's quite a special experience. And the music lovers who come to hear the singers have, you know, another, you know, I guess it's an almost synesthetic experience, you know, where you know, the senses are intermingled and you see with your ears and you hear with your eyes as you're moving around the gallery. So
I love it. I absolutely love it when multiple disciplines can find ways.
Opera is one of the original progenitors of that concept of bringing in all of the various media that it does. So it's quite an experience, and you mentioned, you know, hearing it live. So we hope people will. Both of these operas, incidentally, are under 2 hours worth of music with one intermission each. You know, they're shorter than the average superhero movie or comic book movie these days. They are great first operas. You don't have to know anything about them to go and just sit back and listen and realize, oh, that's familiar. I've heard that before. Or, okay, I know this story. Yeah.
I played some music from Bohème last Saturday afternoon, and it caused a lady to call in and pledge because she heard that familiar melody.
Yeah.
And it brought back something significant to her. Talk about great arias.
I was going to say that's
principal moments in an opera, something I guess that those who know the opera would look forward to, certainly in Tosca, is the is Tosca's aria
Vicidarte.
I live for art, I live for love.
Exactly.
What's the context?
It comes at really the dramatic climax of the opera, where the Baron Scarpia, who is trying to root out this escaped political prisoner and root out other fellow revolutionaries like Tosca's lover, Cavaradossi, the painter, the tenor. He's trying to cut, I guess, what we would call a PG-13 deal with her, if you will. And she just bemoans her fate that she's been a singer. She's tried to be an artist. She's tried to serve God. She's tried to do justice to her art. And, you know, this is how, you know, this is how I'm repaid with this monster of a sadist who wants to, you know, make my life even less pleasant than it is in this act already. And so, but it is, it's one of those, it's a signature aria. Tosca literally is the sole focus. Scarpia is on stage with her, but usually is dead still. It's one of those arias where the as if a monologue caused all the action to freeze, mm-hmm. and the only drama was in this this incredibly vulnerable, passionate, and powerful voice. And in this case, we've got the classic 1953 recording of Tosca by Maria Callas.
It's beautiful. And that was again?
That was Maria Callas in one of her signature roles from 1953 with the Orchestra of La Scala and her mentor, Tullio Serafin, one of the great Italian maestros that kind of connects our more modern era to the previous one. So it's a classic. Many people say that is perhaps the single greatest opera recording ever made.
Really?
And it's certainly, it's one of those desert island choices. So thanks for playing it.
I'm glad. I must tell you, Scott Williamson is the one that brought the music, and suggested what we play. So all of these wonderful selections, thank you for putting that together.
Oh, my
and
pleasure.
Making that
this is
available
been fun.
To us. And have we left anything out?
Is oh, we've anything? Talked about a lot, haven't we? We've talked about the Live in HD season. We've talked about WVTF Music's introduction to the Met radio broadcasts starting in December, 12:06 on Friday afternoon before every Saturday broadcast, featuring our colleague Stephen White, Opera Roanoke principal guest conductor and Metropolitan Opera conductor.
Yep.
We've talked about our apprentice program. We've got an opportunity to hear them on the 14th, and we're all getting ready for Tosca, which is the 27th and 29th. And if listeners can't get enough opera, we've got a fundraiser on October 19th, the Maestro Award, honoring Bobby and Jane Sandel for all their contributions to our community, honoring our partnership with Virginia Western. That's going to be a fun dinner at the Shenandoah Club. And again, you can get answers to all these things by reaching us online at operaroanoke.org or 982-2742, which on those old phones used to spell out 982-ARIA. Don't think it dispels that out anymore.
Oh, dare I say,
but that
I
number,
miss those
that
days.
540-982-2742 will get you our main office. So.
Wow.
Thanks so much, Jeff.
Well, Scott Williamson, Artistic Director with Opera Roanoke, thank you very much for giving of your time today and sharing this with you, and I hope we can do it again.
I look forward to it.
And I forget what it is that the Met host always says, the opera version of break a leg.
Oh, we say break a leg. We all say toy, toy, toy.
Toy, toy, that's what I was thinking of.
Exactly.